This episode is brought to you by Heidy. Imagine kicking back while a HIPAA-compliant AI scribe writes your soap notes for free. Yes, you heard us right. Heidy is free. I'm Dr. Tom, Heidi's CEO and founder, and we started Heidy to stop clinicians wasting their life on clinical documentation. Heidy transforms your consult babble into crisp, clear soap notes, personalizing itself with every edit. One day, Heidy will be your AI resident, looking through research, explaining plans, and doing anything you don't want to. If you currently pay for an AI scribe in your practice, you should swap to Heidy. We'll even credit you for anything you've already paid. Dive into the description for the link and make your practice the envy of every stethoscope in town. Sign up and watch Heidy work its magic, all for free, because you've got better things to do.
As physicians, we have to think a lot on our feet. On this episode, we learn how to think faster and talk smarter from the guy who wrote the book on it. Hey, this is Brad Block, host of The Physician's Guide to Doctoring. This is a personal and professional development podcast for physicians where we have experts on the show that try to teach us everything we should have been learning while we were memorizing Krebs cycle. Welcome back to the podcast. On today's episode, we have a super special guest, someone that I was really hoping would reply. And when he did, I was honored that he was interested in being on the podcast. We have Dr. Matt Abrahams. He is a leading expert in communication with decades of experience as an author, educator, podcast host himself, and a coach. And he's a lecturer in organizational behavior at Stanford University's Graduate School of Business, where he teaches popular classes in strategic communication and effective virtual presenting. Today, we're going to be talking about strategic communication, specifically his recent book, Think Faster, Talk Smarter, How to Speak Successfully When You're Put on the Spot, because that's what often happens to us. We have these spiels, because I still haven't come up with a better word than spiel, for those East Coasters that understand the Yiddish. These stories that we tell our patients, these explanations that we've honed over many times, and we're not often put on the spot because we develop these. But then, in the middle of the visit, we are put on the spot. It happens all the time. So that's really going to be the focus of today's talk, is we're going to be referencing that book where he provides tangible, actionable skills to help even the most anxious speakers succeed when speaking spontaneously. And his previous book also applies to us, Speaking Up Without Freaking Out, 50 Techniques for Confident and Compelling Presenting. Dr. Matt Abrahams, thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Excited to be here with you. Thanks for having me.
Let's get right into it. So as I was saying, you know, a moment ago, we sometimes do impromptu speaking, but a lot of the speaking that we do isn't, right? Because we tend to say the same things over and over. We have these scripts in our heads that are really honed, right? We learn from each previous interaction and we might change it a little bit from time to time. My first question is, how do we balance staying with a script that's been honed over many encounters, but still remaining mentally agile in the moment?
Yeah, and that's a problem that many of us face. It's not just doctors who have this issue. A lot of us say the same thing over and over again. I'm a teacher. I teach the same content. Well, we have to remind ourselves, first and foremost, that we are in service of the people we're talking to. Doctors are in service of their patients. I'm in service of my students. And the information you are sharing with them is new to them. So while it's old hat to you potentially, it's new to them. And we have to remind ourselves of that. All of us who have some level of expertise suffer from the curse of knowledge and the curse of passion. We know too much about what we're speaking on, and we care too much about it. And because of that, we can slip into these pitfalls that get in the way of transmitting the information we want. We use jargon, we talk quickly, we use acronyms. We must remind ourselves that we are in service of the audience. You know, the only antidote to the curse of knowledge and curse of passion is empathy. And it turns out that if we take that few moments to remind ourselves that this is new for our audience and how do we actually craft content to make it accessible to them, it ultimately saves us time. Because if we don't communicate clearly, we're having to repeat ourselves, bad outcomes might happen, so we have to do more work. So what feels like a little more work up front actually, I believe, saves us a tremendous amount of time on the back end, and it enhances the quality of the relationship. So I think the answer to your question is simply, we have to remind ourselves it's new to the people we're talking to, and we also have to think about how best can we translate what we're saying for them to make it accessible.
So let's say we do that, right? Let's say we make it accessible, but we're still in this rehearsed speech, right? A rehearsed speech that's not using jargon, a rehearsed speech that's not using acronyms, but we're still like, it can get to the point where we're thinking about something else as we're saying it, but then I'm not responsive to the patient, right? We're not there for the patient because we're off somewhere else.
So I think one of the best ways to get around that is to, again, double down on being other focused. Start by asking questions. So instead of coming in and going into the spiel, as you said, and instead go in and say, I have some information to share with you, but let's start with what are your questions about it? So that you can, and when they ask you the questions, that forces you to pay more attention and take the information that you know and use it to address their answer. So I'm not saying that you can't use some of that rote response that you have, but you make it much more present focused and will have to tailor it to their question. I recommend that you ask questions, lead with questions, force yourself to paraphrase the information that they share with you. Paraphrasing requires you to listen in a very different way than if you're just listening to know when it's your turn to speak. So we have to actively counter some of these over-rehearsed muscles that we have so we can be more agile and responsive.
I think taking that a step further, because there are some physicians that, you know, the patient comes in and you know the patient's diagnosis. Oh, you're being sent to me because you have bladder cancer. You're being sent to me because you have thyroid cancer. Like, we already know the diagnosis. But other physicians, we don't know the diagnosis, right? We have to figure it out. And then at the end of the visit, we're explaining everything. So if I can take what you're saying and kind of take it a step further, as we're giving that explanation, we can pause frequently for questions. Like, give them, like, take it into chunks instead of like, listen, it's my turn to talk. I'm going to get this whole thing out. Pause. Am I making sense? Pause. Am I making sense? And then using the words that they use in their question in the explanation, it's also a way to make sure that you're present and paying attention, because that's going to require a lot of mental effort. That's a big cognitive load right there that you're doing because you're needing to use their words to explain your thoughts.
Absolutely. And I'll even take you one step further. Wouldn't it be cool if in the reminder for their appointment that most of these electronic, you know, medical record systems send out, you actually populated it with a request for them to come prepared for certain questions, right? Like, we're going to start the visit with me answering your questions. So they come in primed with their questions, and then you can just start the interaction right away. You can say, you know, as we set up in advance. So you can turn this whole thing into a conversation where both parties are present-oriented, you're engaged in empathetic dialogue, and people are going to get more value out of it because they feel like you are responsive, and it allows you to tailor your message as you're listening to their questions. You get a good idea of where they are emotionally and information-wise, knowledge-wise on the topic. I think it just makes these interactions so much better and can really help not just the person to understand, but to help the person feel good about the experience.
It's interesting you said that. There's a urologist out there. His name is David Kames. The company's called Well Prepped. And so what he does is he has information that he sends out to them beforehand. Like, this is your diagnosis. This is what I'd like you to know about your diagnosis. Now, not everyone's going to read it, but for those who do, they're able to have a lot more of an informed and detailed discussion. So they come prepared. Yes, you're giving your patient homework. It's worked out really well, and his company's doing well.
My father recently passed away. He had coronary issues.
Oh, I'm sorry.
His cardiologist said, I'm going to come in tomorrow around this time to the hospital. Here are the things that I'd like to talk to you about. Take a moment to think about these so you have your questions prepared. I mean, one, I felt great that he spent that extra, 2 minutes of his time to connect with me in that way. But also, the conversation we had was much more efficient because I had specific questions. He knew I was prepped. So I think there are ways to avoid some of the things you initially asked in the question. It takes a little bit of time up front, but I would argue, as I said earlier, it saves you a lot of time on the back end.
Yeah. So there are times that we can do that, and there are times that we can't, right? Patients coming into the emergency department, you're not going to be able to. So you're on your way to the hospital while you're in the ambulance. Here's what I want you to look at. Yeah. But there are plenty.
50% of your interactions, they took advantage of some of the things we're talking about. I think that's going to dramatically help you and the patients that you serve. So it doesn't have to be, they're always and never don't exist often in communication. You know, it depends as the modus operandi, but at least trying to do these things, I think will make a big difference.
Right. And a lot of those visits where you do know the diagnosis are often the more complicated things, right? When people come to see me and they have a sinus infection, they're not going to need some ridiculously long explanation. But if they're coming in because they've had chronic sinus infections for a long time and they might need sinus surgery, now that's a different subject altogether and having them read up on what sinus surgery is, what we do, why we do it, what the anatomy is, that type of thing is going to be a lot more helpful. So for those, a lot of times it lines up that way that those complicated visits where you would benefit from having that information are the ones where you kind of know what you're looking at. Sounds like I think the entire field of, or not the entire field, but a lot of neurosurgery is probably that way. People come in, and they've already had their images, they already know what's going on, and we've got tons of examples. So let's say we are in our heads a little bit, right? We're in our heads, we're giving one of those spiels, and we're not like mentally engaged, right? We're like off track. How do we get back on? Do you have any tips for getting back on track? Or at least masking that we've gone off track?
A couple things come to mind. One, just pause for a moment. You could say in the middle of it where you feel like you're going on a tangent or you're not connecting or the person's not understanding, just say, let me take a pause for a quick second. It's okay. We feel, especially when we are in the position of expert, and doctors are certainly in the position of expert often, we feel like we have to be quick to respond and we have to keep saying something. But sometimes the best thing you can do is say, let me pause for a second and recalibrate. And then you do. It's not the end of the world. In fact, there's some evidence that says self-correcting actually enhances your credibility because you're demonstrating you are caring about this interaction in the moment. So that's one thing. The other thing I like to do as a teacher, and I know it's not the same as being a doctor in these circumstances, but when I feel I'm off course or I'm not connecting or the information isn't landing, I'll pause and I'll ask the audience, my students, a question. So as a doctor, I think you could do the same thing. If you feel like you're not connecting, et cetera, just say, hey, let me pause for a second. And at this moment, what's your biggest concern about what we've talked about so far? Right? And that pause, one, allows you to reset. And two, it primes the patient or the person you're talking to help you focus. Because they say, the most important thing I say, when you said that word, whatever it is, serious, I'm really, what does that mean? Right? So all of a sudden, it helps you focus. So I think recognizing that you don't always have to have an immediate response and that it's okay to recalibrate yourself. And then second, you use questions to figure out where the person's at. And just by virtue of asking them the question, it re-engages them.
I think your answer to my next question might be the same as the answer that you just gave. Let me make sure. So sometimes we're actively thinking about the problem as we're talking, right? Like we're figuring out what the diagnosis is as we're reviewing the images and as we're talking to the patients, like the communication and the thinking, it's all happening at the same time. And sometimes you come to a conclusion and then some new evidence, some new information is introduced and you have to change your answer, right? Oh, turns out that's not your diagnosis. This is you're not having facial migraines. You're actually having sinus infections. Like that's what I didn't realize you had a CAT scan. Oh, I didn't think you had a, right? Any advice for improving communication when we have to think and talk simultaneously?
So a couple things, and you're right, some of this is similar to what I said. It's okay to take a beat. I know there's a tremendous pressure on doctors to see patients at a certain frequency and a certain clip. But again, sometimes taking the shorter, or the little pause up front saves you time on the back end, and you have to make that a judgment. And then second, I'm a huge fan of structure. And structure, I believe, really helps you think on your feet. So let me give you an example of what I mean by structure. Structure is just a logical connection of ideas. It's a pathway you go down. There is a structure that I would love for all doctors, actually everybody, to learn because it can really help. It's three questions. What, so what, now what? When you're making a diagnosis, the what is your diagnosis? Here, I have sinus. I believe you have a sinus infection. The so what is, what does that mean for you? Well, it means maybe you have to do nasal rinsing, or if it's really bad, we'll give you antibiotics, whatever. I've had several sinus infections, so I'm reliving these experiences. And then the now what is, here are the steps that I'd like you to take. By having that structure, the answer to those three questions, it helps you as the care provider to package up your response. So you don't have to be spending part of your time thinking about how am I going to tell this patient this? You're going to say what, so what, now what? So you actually have more cognitive bandwidth. You're freeing up more cognitive energy to focus on what you're going to say. You know how you're going to say it. Now you just have to think about what to say. So you actually make yourself more efficient at communication by relying on a structure. Because whenever we have to speak, we have to do two tasks simultaneously. What am I going to say and how am I going to say it in a way that makes sense to the person? Well, if I know how I'm going to say it to make sense to the person, I can more focus on what I'm saying. So pausing. And then relying on a structure can really help. Now, the other part of your question is course correction. And I think that's just something we all have to do is new information comes in and we just have to say, oh, with that new information, that might change things. Let me pause for a second and think about it. And then you just come back with your new response. I think a lot of doctors, at least in my experience as a patient, and I have friends who are doctors, there's this pressure to, you're the expert, so you need to know. And if something changes, that somehow implies that you're not that expert. I think, in fact, that's...
You were wrong. You drew an incorrect conclusion, and you're supposed to be infallible.
Right. And in fact, I think that the doctors I respect the most are the doctors who actually say, hey, this is my suspicion, I need more evidence, et cetera. You know, I'll be very candid and reveal something. I mean, I have an electrical heart issue, and it's genetic, and it's not typical. I have been labeled medically interesting, which is a patient you never want to be. And what I love so much about my cardiologist is he's very upfront with me. He's like, this is what I think, and we're going to look for new evidence, and this is going to change. And it has. His diagnosis of my condition has changed many times as we're learning more information. But I feel I like the fact that he is very candid and he's willing to change his mind. I think this notion that you have to be an expert boxes us in a way that is actually counterproductive. As long as you set up front, I think this looks this way with the evidence I have. And then if something changes, then it makes sense that things would change. So I think we just have to change our view of it. But getting back to what I just said, taking time and having a structure really can help as well.
In the world of medicine, where every decision can change lives, your peace of mind is crucial. This is where Pattern steps in. Imagine insurance made simple, fast, and personalized just for you. With Pattern, you're not just getting disability and life insurance. You're ensuring your future and protecting your greatest asset, your income. In the past 10 years, Pattern has transformed the way over 20,000 doctors secure their financial well-being. Discover the simplicity of securing your future at patternlife.com or click the link in the description. That's very liberating. What you said is very liberating because it's, you know, we always feel like there's so much pressure on us to be perfect. And the fact that, you know, if we looked at an expert that didn't change their opinion based on new evidence, we'd be like, well, they're not an expert at all, right? We should be holding ourselves to the same standard, which is we can change our opinions in the evidence, in new evidence.
I'll give you a real world example that happened to me. For decades, I've been telling people to help calm yourself down, you should take some deep breaths. And I always focused on the inhalation, take a deep, slow inhale in. It turns out, and you might know this better than I as a medical professional and those listening in, all of the magic, the relaxation response all happens on the exhale. And I just learned that a few years ago. And I have told everybody I was wrong. The inhalation is not as important as the exhalation. And I believe that that has not hurt my credibility as I've learned this new information. Science provided new stuff. So I think it is appropriate to give the best information you can and then make adjustments. And I do think it's liberating and helpful.
Absolutely. So earlier you said, you know, when we're talking to our patients and we're making these pauses and we're trying to read their facial expressions, we're going to make sure that they're understanding what we're saying so that we can pivot if we need to. Do you have a method for that as well? Like for reading the room? And actually, this is something that I'm trying to teach my kids, right? Like I'm already upset about one thing. And now you're going to like, just guys, I always, when we say it to them, we're trying to get them to understand what that means. Read the room. But how do we, is there a method for reading the room to making sure we're being understood as we're communicating?
So the single best way to do it is to ask, is to be very overt, is to say, what about what I just said makes sense to you? Where are the areas of concern? Taking the time to verbally check in. And what I recommend to everybody, especially when you are revealing complex information, and often a medical diagnosis and treatment plan can be complex, to give the person time to digest it. So you might give the diagnosis and then say, I know I've shared a lot, take a moment or two, and then I'd love to hear where you have questions about what I said. And give them that moment because they can feel, I mean, from a patient's perspective, the doctor is the expert. And we don't like to waste people's time, especially experts' time. So we might rush to say, no, I understand it. So I, rather than saying, did I make sense or did you get it? I might say, in what I've said, what is most confusing to you? So I'm giving them permission. I'm assuming that something was confusing. Just tell me what it was, rather than making it a yes, no answer, because most people will default to no, right? No, I don't have any questions, when in fact they have a lot of questions. So giving them time and then phrasing a question that actually invites them in. Now, there's a whole bunch of nonverbal stuff you can pay attention to. The problem with nonverbals is they don't always mean what we think they mean. I'll give an example that's not medically related. I had a student once, the whole time I'm talking, he's nodding his head like this. I'm like, oh, he's totally connecting with me, learning everything I want. Well, he drops his pen and bends down to pick it up. He was wearing a hoodie, and I see he's got earbuds in. He wasn't listening to a darn word I was saying. So the behavior I was attributing to, he's connecting and learning, was he wasn't even listening. My point is, what we see is not always what we get. So you look for patterns. So it's not just one behavior, you look for patterns. So if somebody's looking away, if they have a puzzled look on their face, if they turn to somebody they're in the room with to see if they understand, these are all cues and clues that they might have questions. So you need to pay attention. You need to be vigilant to what's happening in the moment. But all the research says fidelity, that is accuracy and clarity of transmission, which is what doctors are all about. You want to give accurate information. You need to do fidelity checking. And fidelity checking is best done verbally. What more can I tell you to help you understand this?
Mm-hmm.
In what I said is the most confusing for you. Those are fidelity checks that actually get you information that you can respond to.
And those pauses that you're talking about where it gives them some time to process, that's actually come up in other interviews we'd had about breaking bad news. So if you're giving someone bad news, often what you can do is, I'm just going to let you digest that information. I'm going to go across the hall. I'm going to see another patient. I'm going to give you some time to digest it, get on the phone, talk to someone, process it. I'll be back in a little bit, and then we can continue. Or, you know, even schedule something soon in the future. Okay, I'm not going to leave you hanging. We have a plan. This is what we're going to do, but we're going to do a check-in a couple of days because I'm sure some questions are going to come up, right? Like these. So giving them scheduled, not just, sometimes it's just a couple of seconds, you know, take a breath, let the patient process, don't just hammer through the visit, but there are other ways to go about it as well. Yeah.
Absolutely. The only thing I will add to that is if you say you're coming back, come back. If you say you're going to contact them, because you're putting your credibility on the line when you commit to that. And if you don't, then you suffer consequences of that. But absolutely, especially with emotions, it takes time to process those emotions. And I think that's good advice, because if somebody gets very emotional, the information that follows is often not heard or heard accurately.
Yeah, they come from a place of fear, and it's so hard to learn new information when you're in that headspace, right? Like you've got so many things that are swirling around in there, that how are you going to possibly process complex medical information?
And that's true for anything. It's not just medicine. When people get emotional, they don't process well.
Plenty of parenting podcasts about that as well. When your kid's having a meltdown, Not really the time to teach a lesson. Yeah. What about when we counter resistance? This happens a lot to us where we'll recommend a workup, a treatment, change their diagnosis. And you'd be surprised how attached people are to their diagnoses. Like you've thought your whole life that you've had allergies, only to find out you don't have allergies. All those things that you thought were allergies were something else. And people, they just, it's hard for them to let that go. So do you have any recommendations when you encounter that type of resistance?
Yeah. So that's tough. I mean, resistance is tough in any regard. If you're a salesperson trying to sell something and people think you cost too much or your product's not as effective, right? So resistance is hard. Anticipating that resistance can help. You might reframe your messaging or approach based on it. So I think every time you have a diagnosis, it's important to think, why might this person hesitate or have some resistance? I think that's a good mental exercise for any communicator, regardless of job. When you start meeting the resistance, you have to think about why might the person be holding on to that point of view, even in the face of counter information, and target it there. Maybe if somebody has always thought they had allergies, that gives them some sense of agency or control, because that's, you know, and by changing that, you're taking away some of that agency or control, or some other, it has some impact on their attachment to that diagnosis. So maybe you talk about that.
Sometimes it's because they've seen a bunch of other doctors before, other healthcare professionals. They've told them this thing. They think of themselves as someone who has a good judge of character. So they've put their faith in these people and found out that those people were wrong. So now they might take it to mean, well, that means I'm not a good judge of character if I trusted these people and they're wrong.
And that's clearly something that could happen. I would try to bring people into the present moment and say, So if you were, so make it subjunctive, if you were to take this new diagnosis, what might it mean for your short-term and long-term health? Get them seeing what's possible in the future rather than having them anchored to the past. So I would ask questions like, what might this mean for you in the future? And how might this change the way you feel physically and mentally about your condition? Another technique that works really well in persuasion in general is to have the patient or to ask the other person, what would it take for you to actually change your current position? So I have never seen any tests of this in the medical space, but if somebody is holding a belief that's not the same belief you have, one of the best ways to get somebody to change the belief is not to throw all the reasons why they should, but ask them, what would it take you to change this belief? And what would be the benefits if you were? So it actually requires them to do the hard work, and they end up being more convinced when they do it rather than you do it. So some version of that might work in the medical setting. I don't know of any research that has done that, or at least I haven't read it, but that might help.
I'll try it and let you know. You know,
yeah, let's do it.
A lot of times in healthcare, you know, we have tons of visits a day and we're always trying to iterate, do things a little differently to try and move through the visit and get the patient on board with their healthcare goals.
So I think it's great. I think it's great. The only thing I would add to that practice is at the end of every day, take 30 seconds to reflect about what worked and what didn't. We are often so busy or so exhausted that we don't take the time to say, hey, I tried that differently and it worked because of this, or it didn't work because of that. And learn from it and make adjustments and change your behavior so that next time it's more efficient. You know, I tell people the only way we get better at communication is three things: repetition, reflection, and feedback. And so we need to practice and try different things. We need to reflect what worked and what didn't. And we need to get feedback because we are not the best judges of our communication. It's important to check in with your patients and say, what could I do to help you next time to be more clear or to help? And take that information and advice. And everybody's different.
And there are plenty of those opportunities for feedback. A lot of times people try to be so deferential. They're like, no, it was great. But, you know, sometimes even those, like those one-star Google reviews that pop up, it might be a run-on sentence and someone that was never going to be satisfied, but there might be actionable feedback in there. Might be something in there that you can say, you know what? This person's verbalized what maybe other people have encountered with me in the past. What can I do a little differently to change it? So there is information out there that we can use to learn from, to get feedback. Because when you're in residency, you're constantly getting feedback. Once you're out in training, it's kind of harder to get.
Absolutely. And I'll say the way to get better feedback is to be very specific about the feedback you're looking for. Don't say, was it good for you? Because Everybody's going to say, yes.
Okay.
But if you say, what could I have said differently to help? When you ask for more specific, clear feedback, you are going to get more specific and clear feedback.
I love it. There's one more question I want to get to because we're coming to a close here. And that is, has nothing to do with what we've been talking about before, but I think it does because it's the what, so what, now what, small talk. And we want minimal small talk during these visits because we have plenty of patients waiting. Small talk's important because it helps us build rapport with our patients. But I'm talking about small talk when we're going to conferences, when we're at meetings, when we're, right, we're often in these situations and it's so hard. You have a method. You have a technique for small talk. So can you just, before we close, can you tell us about that?
Well, so one of the biggest things we need to do in small talk is, one, reframe it. Many of us dread small talk. Big, good things happen in small talk. So we need to rebrand this. Think about your friendship network. My hunch is somebody in your friendship network became a friend initially through small talk, right? So good things happen. You learn about yourself. You learn about others. You collaborate. The biggest thing I think that was just totally transformed the way I see small talk came from somebody I interviewed on my podcast, Think Fast, Talk Smart. Her name's Rachel Greenwald. She is an academic and a professional matchmaker. Pretty cool combination there. She said the goal in small talk is to be interested, not interesting. Many of us go in thinking we have to be really, really interesting. It's like playing tennis and everything I say has to be an ace over the net. When in fact, good small talk is more like that game of hacky sack where I'm just serving the ball to you so you can serve it back to me without it hitting the ground. We have to coordinate work together. So if it's about being interested, it means being curious, asking questions, commenting on things in the environment, just to get it going. So it's all about approaching it with curiosity rather than dread. And the goal is to get the other person talking. My mother-in-law had a black belt in small talk. She was amazing. And she did it with three simple words: tell me more. When you ask somebody to tell you more, you demonstrate interest, you give them space to expand, and you say that I want to be present and learn from you. So simply by taking the time to be interested and use phrases like tell me more, ask questions, can transform how small talk goes for you. And it makes it more enjoyable.
What about those instances where you keep hitting dead ends, right? Like you're asking people questions and they're just giving you couple word answers and they're asking you, and it's not hacky sack, right? They're not hitting the, I think the assumption in the hacky sack is that the other person is skilled. This person has two left feet and the ball keeps hitting the ground, right? Like, what do you do in that situation?
Well, so either you try to exit politely or you try to change to a topic that might be more interesting, or you ask questions that get them to expand more. You can say things like, tell me about a time when, or what would it be like if? And these are questions that invite people to say more. Now, you know, anybody who has a teenage child, as I do, know that sometimes, you know, they're training to be CIA operatives and get very little out of them, in which case you might end the conversation. But often you can find a vein that will invite people to speak a little bit more, especially if you can make it really relevant and interesting to them. It might take a little fishing around, but I think you can get there.
Keep probing until you strike oil.
Exactly.
Matt Abrahams, thank you so much for being on the podcast. For all the listeners, check out his podcast, Think Fast, Talk Smart, and his book, Think Faster, Talk Smarter, How to Speak Successfully When You're Put on the Spot. Thank you so much for your time.
It was great to be with you. Thank you. And I appreciate the fact that you're trying to help medical professionals communicate better. So critical.
Thanks again from Heidi. Elevate your practice with a free AI scribe, zero cost, HIPAA compliant, and time saving. Ready to swap? We've got you covered for past AI scribe expenses. Head to HeidiHealth.com, get started, and make your practice the envy of every stethoscope in town.
Thanks for listening. I have a favor to ask. You listened to the episode until the end, which means you either fell asleep or you really liked the episode. So please share it or like it or comment on a social media post or write us a 5-star review, something. It would really help me out. And maybe what you learned from this episode can help someone else too. The views expressed in this episode are those of the interviewer and interviewee and don't represent the views of their employer or even their significant other. Even though the magic of podcasting make it sound like I'm talking directly to you, this is not a doctor-patient relationship, and this is not medical advice or financial advice or really any advice. Thank us again for listening to The Physician's Guide to Doctoring.